in 1803 in California in Spanish. We were part of Spain at the time. Medical services have been provided in California in Spanish for 251 years. We came into the United States as a bilingual state. Spanish was one of the official languages. And yet, Latinos are least likely to find a physician who speaks Spanish. The shortage is tremendous. But it's not because this is a new issue. This is California. What we have done for 160 years is chosen to turn our back on this population, not allow it access to the investments we're making in other populations, either for education or health care. They'll wonder why there's an issue.
Dr. David Hayes Bautista, I want to thank you so much for being with us, distinguished professor of medicine and director of the Center for the Study of Latino Health and Culture at the UCLA Medical School. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Salem Progressive Film Series presentation of The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG. This slideshow depicts part two of Barbara Bernstein's radio documentary series, Holding the Thin Green Line, which explores what is at stake in Southern Oregon if the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and Pacific Connected Gas Pipeline get built. From July 27th to the 31st, this slideshow video can be viewed at your own convenience at holdingthethingreenline.org/Jordan Cove slideshow. Then on July 31st from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., we'll hold a live Q&A session with impacted landowners, community organizers, and land and water protectors who are featured in the documentary. Again, that's The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG documentary slideshow screening, July 27th to the 31st, and a live on Zoom Q&A on July 31st. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And it's 8:01, leaving us time at... No, meaning that it is time for Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Rowland. Stay tuned.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your mind. Put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damn it? Look right now, and you will see we're all.
tell by the skin of our teeth as it is. So take heart and take care of your link with life. It's beautiful.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Buffy St. Marie. Carry It On. I wanted to let that song play in its entirety in honor of my old friend, Chief Johnny Jackson, who passed on Friday. And I want to spend the first quarter hour sharing some thoughts about him. I plan to have a guest on to talk more fully about current issues on his beloved Enchiwana, otherwise known by the colonizers as the Columbia River. But for now, I'd like to give some of my own personal thoughts after I read a statement from the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. After I finish that, we will have Catherine McDowell from the Oregon American Civil Liberties Union on for a few minutes to talk about their lawsuit against police targeting of journalists and legal observers and more. So this is the statement from Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission on the loss of Johnny Jackson. The Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission mourns the loss of our elder and commissioner Atwe Johnny Jackson after his recent hospitalization due to COVID-19. Jackson was chief of the Klickitat Band of the Yakima and represented the Yakima Nation at Kritvik with steadfast passion and determination. He spoke from his heart, particularly when involved the river people who call the banks of the Columbia River home. His insights, experience, wisdom, and perspective were forged in the decades of his unrelenting stance to have promises fulfilled and to overcome the hardships endured by the river people as they struggled to retain their connection to salmon and their right to fish for them. At the commissioner's intertribal table, Jackson's voice offered a constant reminder of the deep traditions that connect the tribes to the land, water, and salmon, and the raw wounds still felt from the loss of Celilo Falls, where he fished as a young man, and the hundreds of tribal homes, villages, and businesses displaced by dams. His dedication and tenacity has been and will continue to be an inspiration for his people, his fellow commissioners, and the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission staff. Kritvik's executive director, Jamie A. Pinkham, stated, "It is difficult to imagine the Columbia River without Johnny Jackson living by its side. I will miss his friendship and humor, and he left us valuable lessons, often delivered in his trademark candor, that we must never forget. And we must never give up." I met Johnny Jackson probably back even in 1985, if not soon after, when I moved to this area and got involved in the fishing rights struggle, kind of the second or third or fourth or 100th wave of the fishing rights struggle of the people of the Enchiwana. It's a Sahaptin for the big river, and its tributaries, where people have continued to fish despite all obstacles since, as they say, time immemorial, and since the colonization of this land, the the coming of a industrial fishing with large fish wheels that harvested massive amounts of salmon, the building of the dams in 1938-57, the ones that affected their communities, the Bonneville and the Dalles Dam, which flooded Celilo Village and Celilo Falls. And actually, it didn't flood Celilo Village, from what I understand. It actually, they forced them to move off, and then they turned that area into the park, which you can actually now go to. It's an access point for windsurfers and others. Anyway, long story. And so Johnny Jackson was involved in that because some of his friends, including Wilbur Slokish, who's been on my program, David Sohappy, and others, had been targeted in an undercover FBI sting operation for supposedly fishing out of season on their river. And I think five or seven people end up going to prison, if you can believe it, federal prison. Anyway, Johnny was a steadfast defender of them. And in the middle of all that, he was threatened with eviction from his home at Underwood, Washington, where he lived at one of the so-called in-lieu fishing sites, which were sites that had been flooded, had been either nearby sites of villages or fishing access points, or then were replacements for those sites that were flooded all up and down along where Bonneville flooded the Columbia River. Anyway, they continued to live there with some tension, with, as obviously, the BIA, since they threatened to evict him. And anyway, it's been a long fight both within, you know, against some of their own institutions, because they were always kind of the most, I guess you could say, the avant-garde, the strongest traditionalists and defenders of their treaty rights. So he won that battle and kept on living at Underwood for many, many years. And they won other battles. They ended up getting Celilo Village rebuilt, the houses that were kind of falling into disrepair, they rebuilt, and they have maintained their access to all their traditional in lieu sites, as I said, which had been thriving villages for centuries, basically. Celilo Village is actually the longest continually inhabited village site, I believe, in North America, just right up there along the Columbia River, or I should say the Inchiwana River. He also got involved in many, many other struggles. As we know, Yakima was where the Hanford Nuclear Reservation was taken part of the reservation and became one of the most nuclear toxic sites in the world, if not the most. And they've been fighting along with non-Native allies to get that cleaned up the best we can. He was always available to go to hearings and lend his voice. He got involved in the forest struggle in Ola Hill, just up Highway 26, where people became aware that there was a important traditional spiritual site for the Native people. The Klickitat people of the mid-Columbia, mid-Inchiwana, had a wide territory. The Klickitat Cascade people had a wide territory, and they had fished at Willamette Falls. They gathered berries on the slopes of Mount Hood. They hunted on all their different traditional areas. And Enola Hill was in their traditional territory, and he got very involved in that and testified at an important court case to protect it. Unfortunately, we were able to protect that particular logging site, but so it goes. so many other issues, so many other struggles he's been involved in over the years. Most recently, when I came back to Oregon after many years abroad, he got involved in the fight to stop the Nestle water bottling plant at actually a traditional sacred spring of the Klickitat Cascade people. In fact, I think I had him on. I had some tape of him talking about his knowledge of that site. There was actually a traditional village site there before the flooding of the Inchiwana River. And that was his contribution was very important to that as well. And we did win that battle. So, Johnny Jackson, you fought hard. You were beloved by your family and your community. You fought many struggles. You won many struggles. And we will certainly carry it on in your spirit as we move forward. So thank you. Thank you, Chief Johnny Jackson. You will be well remembered. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say again. I would like to talk more about him next week. And now I will introduce our guest, who will only be able to be on for 10, 15 minutes. And we won't be taking your calls to speak with her, but the entire second half of the program, we can talk about what we are going to talk about. So across the United States, during the widespread protests against police violence and systemic racism against African Americans, there have been numerous incidents of journalists being targeted by police, including arrest, beatings, pepper spraying, and more. This has also been true in Portland, where the protests have been particularly prolonged and intense. At the end of June, the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon and a local law firm, Brown, Hagee, and Borden, filed a lawsuit against the City of Portland, the Portland Police Bureau, and other local law enforcement agencies working under PPP's direction. I just want to read from a Jefferson Public Radio article. The suit claims that police in Portland have tear gassed, pepper sprayed, beaten, and arrested journalists, observers, and other neutral bystanders who are documenting the police's response to protests. Quote, the police should not be shutting down the public's access to the messages and realities of protests in Portland streets where people are calling for an end to police killing of black people, said Kelly Simon, interim legal director of the ACLU of Oregon, in a statement. Police in Portland are making a mockery of the First Amendment by targeting journalists using excessive force and by using indiscriminate crowd control weapons. Police actions have had a chilling effect on the media and protesters. The lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court in Portland and lays out multiple reports of violence against journalists at the hands of police. More recently, U.S. District Judge Michael Simon agreed to allow attorneys for the Oregon ACLU to add the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Marshals Service as defendants in its lawsuit. And of course, the situation has become even more intensified and even more complicated, and we are at the eye of a national and international media story, and we'll see where it goes. Hopefully we'll get some light when we talk to today's guest, Catherine McDowell. She's the ACLU of Oregon's Vice President for Policy and board member. In 2016, she helped organize the ACLU Legal Observer Program, which she is still involved with, including during the current protests. Are you with us, Catherine?
Yeah, good morning, Paul.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm well. I'm well. And I just want to say before we begin, that was a very powerful tribute to Chief Johnson. Thanks so much for that.
Yeah. Old school. Don't make them like they used to. Anyway, so, so first tell us, I'm really interested. I don't know if I've ever actually heard sort of a story of the origins of, like, legal observers. I don't know if that's something you know about, but certainly you know about the ACLU's Legal Observer Program. So you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, let me just say we can't start talking or talk at all about legal observers without acknowledging the National Lawyers Guild, which has had legal observers out at protests for years and really really is the foundation of legal observer work in this country. The ACLU in many states also has its own set of legal observers to ensure that in large protests like we have here, that the NLG has support from other folks. There's really, since 2016 in Portland in particular, there have been so many protests that the ACLU decided to organize its own set of legal observers. And we're out there, you know, as a team with the National Lawyers Guild Legal Observers. So that's, you know, the origins of it are really from the Guild, and I think it was originally organized really just to protect the rights of protesters, to have neutral observers observing police conduct toward protesters and to hold them accountable if they police protests in a way that violate the First Amendment.
So I imagine NLG probably helped you with maybe the early trainings. Want to talk, what is involved in becoming a legal observer?
Yeah, well, we do carefully train folks, and then as protests evolve and develop, we continue to train folks and continue to focus on, you know, the dynamics of the protest movement at the time. So, you know, we began by taking a set of volunteers, teaching them all the basic know your rights information that they need to have to keep themselves safe and that they can advise others on. And then we really just help folks understand the dynamics of being a legal observer, the absolute need to maintain neutrality. We are not at protest as a member of the protest group. We are there like media, observing and recording what we see. So we train folks about you know, safety protocols first and foremost, and then ensure that people really understand the role. We're there to support protesters by recording what we see in a neutral way.
And so I take it you've been monitoring the protests by social media, I take it, recently?
Yeah, well, one of our protocols is we make sure that our legal observers who are in the field understand what is happening. You know, it, sometimes when you're in one part of a protest and there's an announcement or there's a dynamic in another part of the protest, you know, anybody who's been at a protest will tell you that it's can be very difficult sometimes to hear announcements, to understand the crowd dynamics. So part of our safety protocols is to ensure that our legal observers on the ground know what's happening at all times so that they can keep themselves safe and also be in a position to record any police actions and police brutality toward protesters. So our legal observer group consists of folks who are on the ground, and I would say at this point extremely brave folks, who are out there with gas masks and ear protection and eye protection. I mean, it is brutal out there right now. But we have those folks on the ground, and then we have a set of support people who monitor what's the reports that we're getting from them, the videos we're getting from them, and in turn, we provide information to them so that they can maintain, you know, their role and continue to do their role in a safe way.
Let me just ask you, are you by chance on speakerphone?
I'm on a microphone. I can. Is there some echo?
Yeah, a little bit.
There. Let me switch. Hang on.
Okay.
Is this better?
Yes, it's a little clearer.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So let's get to the meat of the question. We can, you know, continue to talk about, you know, what the whole process. But so. I read June 6th, which is now like a month and a half ago, an article where there's well over 300 journalists wrongfully arrested or assaulted in the U.S. while covering protests. I'm sure it's, I don't know if you've seen anything more recent that's across the U.S. It's rather staggering and obviously concerning, since the media, it's crucial to have the media, not only legal observers, but the media there to the media, you know, reporting to a broader audience. Talk about what brought the ACLU to bring this lawsuit. What have you heard about and seen in terms of the recent protests here in Portland and the police targeting of in general, but specifically of journalists and legal observers?
Well, let me just say that one really important reason to have legal observers on the ground is you can verify the narratives that come out of the protests, and you certainly have often a police narrative that denies that media is being targeted or that media is being hit or that media is being arrested. When we have folks on the ground and start seeing that, then our alarm bells go off, and that's exactly what was happening in early June. We were absolutely seeing media injured, media shoved, media pushed, media basically being inhibited from doing the critical work of recording police responses to protests. And the starting place is these protests are around police brutality and systemic racism toward Black people. So when we have a police response that basically proves our point, it's pretty disturbing, and I think it absolutely needs to be documented for the public, and that's the job of the media. As legal observers, we, witness this and witness the same conduct toward our legal observers. So we filed a lawsuit. There are various people from the city condemning it, but nobody was stopping it. So we filed a federal lawsuit and asked a federal judge to enjoin that kind of targeting and dispersal of legal observers and the media. And we were successful in getting an injunction against Portland police for acting in that way, for dispersing legal observers and media right at the moment when they need to be recording the police conduct. So that injunction is now in place and is in place through October at this point until the court has a chance to go back and look at entering a permanent injunction. So, and then as I'm sure your next question is going to be, have we included the feds in that? And the answer is yes. That's the action we filed recently. We've added the federal agencies that are now in town to that lawsuit and filed to extend our injunction against the federal government. And that hearing is set for tomorrow.
Oh, wow. Okay, so injunction. We hear a lot about injunctions, and they're basically a temporary holding action until, as you say, a fuller hearing or court case will be heard. So what? I don't know if you can say. I know you're in litigation, so you have to be very cautious in general about what you say. But can you say anything about if there's been an effect from this injunction on the behavior of the police?
Well, that is actually kind of a difficult thing to say because the protests have become so escalated that,
right.
And the federal government has gotten involved, and the federal government, has absolutely, shot at and targeted and been brutal toward the media and toward legal observers. So, in the haze of all that, it's difficult to tell. We are recording all instances that we see of Portland police violating the injunction, and we'll bring those to the court's attention. We do find ourselves having to explain that injunction on the street sometimes, which is distressing. We believe that the Portland police should be well aware of that injunction and following it. It applies to anybody who's clearly marked as press, anybody who's got the green hat, which is the NLG trademark, or the blue vest. All of these are, our blue vest is clearly marked legal observer. So it's not complicated. I mean, anybody who's clearly marked in that way is not subject to dispersal by Portland police when they issue a dispersal order. And the point of that is to allow legal observers and the media to record what the police are doing to try to disperse the crowd. We're asking that a federal court basically subject the federal government to the same restrictions. We don't think this is complicated. I mean, federal agents should not be shooting at the media. They should not be shooting at neutral legal observers who are plainly marked as press and legal observers. And that's what we're asking the court you know, to order tomorrow. The federal government has entered papers, filed papers recently saying that they don't believe they should be subject to those rules, which, you know, I think is a pretty disappointing position. The First Amendment clearly protects the right of media to record the actions of both federal and state law enforcement agents, and that's all we're asking for.
So I know you have to go soon, and please let me know when you do. There's so much to cover, but I wonder if you could just give us a quick overview of some of the, you know, people one of your own, on your own website, the ACLU of Oregon, there's an article saying a constitutional crisis in Portland. Other people have been talking about broad constitutional issues involved in sending these unmarked, unclear who they are, you know, people in camouflage, very discomfiting figures, to say the least, obviously very scary to people who are on the ground. What are some of the constitutional issues that you see involved here? Some of the amendments, even.
Yeah, well, let me just say, it is a pretty frightening situation. What's happening in Portland right now should concern everyone. I think we are absolutely on the front line in the fight to save our democracy. I mean, we've got federal agents attacking protesters in a, you know, completely unprovoked way. And, you know, they're here on the pretense of restoring law and order, but what is ensuing is absolute lawlessness. And I would say, in terms of the cases that have been brought, we've got the ACLU's case to protect media and legal observers. We've got the Oregon Attorney General's lawsuit, which and actually I think there's a TRO being heard on that today, to try to prevent the feds from doing the kind of snatching they're doing in unmarked cars with unidentified agents just picking people up off the street. And then there was a lawsuit just filed yesterday on behalf of Western State Center and some state representatives, basically saying that the federal presence in the city violates the police powers that are assigned to the states and the feds. And so you really have lawsuits from the ACLU raising First Amendment issues, from the Oregon Attorney General raising Fourth Amendment issues around search and seizure, and then the case filed yesterday by Western States and various other plaintiffs raises Tenth Amendment issues around basically the state owning the power constitutionally to police itself. So just right there, within a few weeks, we've had three federal lawsuits raising three separate constitutional issues, and I can tell you there are more lawsuits coming, including a new lawsuit that will be filed today. So tune in to that. The ACLU is filing another lawsuit later today, and then I can guarantee there will be additional lawsuits filed within the next week, raising multiple additional claims. So I guess the answer to your question is there's not just one constitutional right being violated by the federal presence in our city. There are multiple violations, and we're not going to stop until the feds are out of our city and following the Constitution, all of these different amendments. The protesters have a right to protest, and the federal government is here to suppress that, and the ACLU and our allies are here to ensure that that right is fully protected in Portland.
And well, as I warned you in advance, I would try to keep you as long as I could. So I'll ask you one last question. You can answer it or not. Do you know of any other initiatives going on around the country to protect similarly journalists? Because have you heard of this many instances of journalists and legal observers being targeted? I mean, do you think there's a concerted effort going on here? I guess you can't say anything about that, I guess.
Well, I don't know. I do think that, the Trump administration has been clear that what they're rolling out in Portland, they intend to roll out in other cities. And I have no reason to believe that they will operate differently in other cities. And certainly in other cities, there were reports of media and legal observers being targeted by police. So, that really goes to the underlying you know, reason of these protests, which is that police are not, are responding with brutality to the folks that they're, supposed to protect, and that when folks rise up and say, that's not the kind of policing we want, the response is further brutality. And when you have media and legal observers recording that, they're in the crossfire, and they get targeted unless the courts step in to protect them. So, you know, the ACLU, what they're doing here in Portland, they're doing throughout the country, and we certainly, see a lot of solidarity from other parts of the country in terms of supporting what we're doing in Portland, and, you know, intend to do everything we can to support other communities if they become targeted in the same way.
Okay, well, I do want to respect your time limit. So is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
No, I just encourage everybody to, pay attention. This is, as I said, an issue that should concern everybody. I mean, this is the fight to save our democracy. You know, we're taking it to the courts. We're going to use everything we can. But, we need folks to continue to come out and express their opinions and their views on policing, police brutality, and systemic racism, and we're here to protect the rights of all those who seek to go out and express those views.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Catherine McDowell from ACLU of Oregon.
Yeah. I appreciate it. All right. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Yeah, you too. And those words, save our democracy, or I think I heard a report, was it on Democracy Now! Yesterday, or it might have been NPR, I don't know. In the Philippines, the Duterte regime is cracking down on, is it a TV station that they're shutting down? Anyway, there's a huge fight, and they say they have, I think, like 3 months or something, whatever, a few months to save their democracy. Seems like a parallel process is going on here in this country, and it's very disconcerting. And the only thing to do is to carry it on, as Buffy St. Marie says, keep on keeping on. All right, this is your time. You're the KBOO listener, 503-231-8187. The lines are open to talk about that. Hopefully carry on the conversation from Catherine McDowell or other things. We'd definitely like to encourage people who don't ordinarily talk on KBOO Talk Radio. We look for people from identities and communities who are less represented in general in this society and culture in the media. You know who you are. So as they say, step back, step up. Step back those who ordinarily talk and are maybe part of dominant represented identities, and step up everyone else. But anyone is welcome at 503-231-8187. Do I have anybody on cue, Sonia?
Not yet. That line is, as Paul said, folks, the lines are open, 503-231-8187. I've got some music queued up if we want to take a little break, give people time to dial.
Oh, yeah, let's hear a minute or minute and a half of music, sure. We'll be right back. Dave Brubeck, what a great song. All right, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. We only have about 20 minutes left, so if you want to get your call in, you better do it right now, 503-231-8187. I want to talk a little bit more about these press and freedom violations across the country, but it sounds like we've got Dave on the line. Go ahead, Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, great.
Okay, I was in the Navy also. I was in the Navy Seabees.
Mm-hmm.
And I was stationed in Mississippi, Gulfport. And I tell you, every cop that I ever saw was a Klan member. And I know that for a fact because I talked to a lot of guys that were stationed down there with me. We need to not defund the police. We need to de-Klan the police. We need to step up, open our eyes, realize who they are, realize that these are offshoots of Knight Riders. And today, they are just as serious today as they were yesterday, back in the day. I was threatened with arrest, me and another black guy, in Gulfport, Mississippi, for not speaking to two white girls in the Biloxi Mall. We ignored them because I was afraid, and they went and talked to a security guard, and he came up and threatened us and kicked us out of the mall for not speaking to these white girls. So that's all.
That's ironic, since the excuse of actually speaking to a white girl has gotten black men into a hell of a lot of trouble over the years.
Yes.
So what do you think about your fellow Navy man who got...
I wish I was there with him. He needed one more person there with him to represent the U.S. military. It's a shame that he was by himself. And another thing I want to say is, where are all the black people? These kind white people are down there risking their lives for us. So where are we now? Thank you very much.
All right. Okay. So, well, thank you, Dave. 503-231-8187. De-clan the police. There's certainly been problems with someone who is either a Nazi sympathizer or worse, still on the police force. That situation has never been really clarified or resolved, and there are allegations of people who belong to various unsavory formations who are part of the police forces. I can't imagine that all members of police in Portland are such. I'm sure there are some people who are, you know, whatever, liberal democratic voters even. It would be good if they would stand up. Not that, you know, Democrats are the be all and end all, but anyway, long discussion. I would like to see more police start to really formally break ranks, you know, and you know, if they see people wailing on a Navy veteran and st- step in, you know, especially since the Floyd murder. You know, one of the big issues there was the cops just standing by and, you know, either enabling directly or passively allowing a murder to happen right there in front of them. So 503-231-8187, that's the number to call. Don't let too many more minutes pass by or you won't have any time left. So I want to talk a little bit about this, just read a little bit from this article about over 300 journalists targeted. There have been more than 328 press freedom violations between May 26 and June 6. That's like 2 weeks, according to the latest count from the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, a collaboration of advocacy groups such as the Committee to Protect Journalists and the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Those numbers are unprecedented. In just over a week, there have been more violations than the 150 recorded for all of 2019. More than 54 journalists have been arrested. There have also been a total of 208 assaults on reporters so far, 173 of which were by police, according to the data. Within that category, there have been 73 physical attacks on journalists, 47 by police, and 83 instances of reporters being hit by rubber bullets or projectiles. Nick Waters, a senior reporter for investigative journalism website Bellingcat, has also collected 140 incidents of police targeting journalists who are covering the protests in a thread on Twitter. And it goes on and then mentions the ACLU, which took action on Wednesday, filing a class action lawsuit on behalf of journalists who were targeted and attacked by Minneapolis and Minnesota police. So they're active here in Portland, and they were active even before in Minnesota, and as our guest said, elsewhere. Okay, looks like Angela, who doesn't have much time. Go ahead, Angela, you're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to respond to the vet that called in just a few minutes ago.
Uh-huh.
I haven't been to the protests every night, but some of the protests I have, neighborhoods and then downtown as well, I do know for a fact that the strategy is to have white people on the front lines and on the side to protect people of color. And there's organizing going on between different affinity groups, but so much organizing is being done by people of color. They are actually leading a lot of the strategy. So I just wanted to mention that. The pictures are deceiving because the strategy is being, you know, so many people are willing to follow those guidelines and put their bodies there so as to possibly, you know, take the brunt of the abuse, but also possibly use white privilege to maybe get a de-escalated response. I have to go to work, so I just wanted to let people know that if they haven't been on the ground there. So,
thank you so much for that. I was thinking about trying to push back, but I haven't been on the ground, so I was kind of wondering. But thank you. That's a very good response to that. Appreciate it. Okay, that's Angela. Now we've got John, and I guess John isn't with us. 503-231-8187. Just about 10 minutes left. Time flies when you're having fun on the radio. So, folks, this is a big deal. I mean, whether or not there's a concerted action or whether it's just that the police see such a threat to their, I don't know, existential threat, a threat to their ability to act with impunity, whatever it is, if it's just a sort of a general zeitgeist on the part of the police, or whether there's actually some, you know, whether they're communicating. I can't imagine there's anything sort of centrally organized, although, you know, as people have been saying ever since Trump took the presidency, his words sort of set the tone and for racist and repressive actions, and allow more space for racist organizing and basically fascist organizing. It's a crazy, scary times we're in, folks, but as our previous guest from the ACLU said, it's not a time to sit back and watch, but at least a time to actively watch. I don't know. I forgot to ask her if there's a chance for people to actually become legal observers, but I'm sure if you go to the ACLU website, which is linked to on my program page at kboo.fm, that's a Wednesday talk radio at kboo.fm. The title of this program page is ACLU Challenges the Targeting of Journalists and Legal Observers at Protests. You kind of have to tap that into the search bar. It didn't get promoted in time to the home page, the front page. But yeah, 503-231-8187. Looks like we've got Mike on the line. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Calling to say, I've been seeing these Back the Blue movements sort of all around. I live outside of Portland. And I see these Back the Blue movements everywhere. And I always kind of wondered to myself, what does the blue mean here? What does somebody in Sandy really care about, the Portland police officers? What does somebody in, Omaha, Nebraska really care about New York City police officers? Why are they backing specifically the blue? What is the blue here? And I kind of, came to the conclusion it was just some idea of, of law and order, of policing, but there was really no thing connecting all these together. But I kind of see sort of the political tactics of moving the studs into Portland right now as sort of a way to unite this whole movement, that whole sort of more conservative movement of backing the blue, because now it's not just a bunch of different police, sort of unconnected police departments in different cities that really are a local problem. People in Portland want to change the Portland police station or police bureau. That should be a Portland issue, not a national issue. But this is, I feel like, a way to help basically to keep himself relevant as he's failing sort of miserably at the coronavirus response.
Hey, Mike, are you on speakerphone by chance?
I am, yes.
Yeah, could you get off?
Is there a lot of echo? Okay, one second.
Are you there?
Hold on.
Yeah, it's better.
Okay, is that better?
Yeah, thank you. So you're saying this, I didn't even get what you were calling this Back to Blue, or?
Oh, no. I was calling to kind of talk about what I've seen with, wondering about the whole Back the Blue movement and what specifically the blue means if you're maybe you're in Omaha, Nebraska, and you're sort of wary of police defunding in a different city. Why do you care if you're in Omaha, Nebraska? Why does Back the Blue mean specifically back all police officers? It doesn't really, it seems like a weird political movement, because I feel if people in Portland are trying to defund and change the Portland Police Bureau, that should be a local issue, and it has become this national issue. And I really feel the decision to move the feds in, there's a lot of just messed up crap associated with that, but I think one of the reasons why that's happened is as sort of a political play by Trump to unite all these movements on his side, because the argument wasn't really as much about Trump, and it's been about race, but he kind of wants the argument to be about himself coming into the new election. I don't know. It's just it's interesting for me to see how the narrative might be changing around these protests now that the feds have been involved, where it seems to be shifting from sort of a fight for Black lives, and it's still continuing to be that for sure. I mean, that they are definitely more vulnerable. The most vulnerable group, with this new sort of move-in of the feds. But it's sort of spilling even more explicitly onto the sort of political electoral stage, I think.
Yeah, well, and the much talked about culture wars, obviously it's like a perfect talking point for the right wing, but I think it shows it's interesting how it's going to go. I think you're really onto something. Yeah, Back the Blue. I'm sorry, I just didn't pick up on that. The supporting police. I don't know. It all depends on how I think there are. I've often characterized that the die-hard, knee-jerk racist, you know, anti-welfare state, you know, small government, whatever, cluster of ideologies. I call them the Americaners. I think more and more they're revealing themselves to be very, very similar to the sort of the final gasp of the Afrikaner power hold in South Africa. And I think they're very frightened of that. And, you know, what have they got but the police and, you know, these elements of the military that are, you know, there's obviously strong elements of the military that are supporting that agenda. And they're the ones that, you know, Trump and Barr are tapping into. So, yeah, it's the battle lines are being drawn for sure.
Yeah, and it's just, I just see this as a way to kind of turn the narrative more as, you know, a for and against Trump issue, when it was like, you know, it should be like for, you know, Black lives and like, you know, against the sort of, you know, erasure of them.
Except Trump has thrust himself into that role.
What's up?
No, go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted you.
I mean, I just see like as things have been fading. I mean, I saw like the recent right before the feds came in, like the protests were as small as I've ever seen them. Then, you know, now that they came back in, it's like there's just a lot more energy, a lot more stuff, and a lot more content for people to spam across the media to, you know, pick out their point. And you see the stuff, you see like the mom wall. The mom wall is not going to get like reported on in right wing media. Like, people are going to view, like, get pictures of like fire and people fighting, and they're going to use that to say that like we need more federal, you know, more federal pushback. Like, no one's like, people are just going to take whatever information that they want from this and use this to back their own idea. And I think that Trump needs huge battles so he can place himself as the person who can bring peace, even though if you look at this, like, you know, there was already like, you know, if what you're thinking, if peace to you is no protest, there were a whole hell of a lot less protests, a whole hell of a lot less fighting in the streets before the feds came in. But people,
right,
you,
well,
know, you know, trying to argue with a crypto-fascist loved one of mine, you know, and they're like, you know, the Portland police are spineless and Trump had to come in and enforce laws, and he had to make peace in Portland. I'm like, no, okay, first of all,
I gotta run because we have one more caller and we only have 2 minutes left. But thank you for those points. I mean, I think the point is his moves will only succeed if, as Greg Palast said, he's able to dominate and suppress the vote coming up in November, because he's slipping dramatically in the polls. Anyway, if Tim is still there, let's see if we can get you in real quick.
Okay, am I on now?
Yeah.
I'm good, okay. So I got to make this quick. I want to comment about why we need to defund the police nationwide. If you look historically in the U.S., police have always been used to suppress any movement that's been progressive, and they've used violence according to the technology available to them at that time. But at this time, they are a virtual third army all throughout America, supplied with high-tech military weapons, and a lot of them are ex-military themselves, many with PTSD. And some of them probably are on the edge and can be manipulated. So they are a threat. If things continue as they are, it's important to defund them nationally, and that will remove one of the major threats to a progressive movement. They'll have to use the military, the National Guard, but they won't have the police at their beck and call. And the police themselves can be transformed into something that's less aggressive, more protect and serve, like they're supposed to be. Civilians could be recruited with a different attitude.
Well, that's why the Senate Republicans just blocked the bipartisan move to stop military transfers to local police forces, because they obviously see the writing on the wall for sure.
Exactly. So that's why we need to make this nationwide, because otherwise, wherever they exist, they're going to be used, and the people in that area are going to have to face them, in addition to the military and the National Guard and right-wing groups and whoever else. So any factor we can remove or neutralize before it all goes to hell is to our advantage. if we don't want to end up in those private prisons or disappear.
I hate to think in such apocalyptic terms, but it seems like Trump is bound and determined to impose on that. You know, it's a crazy situation. I thank you for that viewpoint, Tim. That's really valuable.
All okay, right.
Well,
we
are
brother.
We hear the strains of the going out music coming up. So I thank everybody who called in. I thank my guest from the ACLU, Catherine McDowell, and stay tuned for more great programming here on KBO Community Radio. And thank you, Sonia, for board hopping. Bye, everybody.
From the Wings Archive, in honor of Pride Vancouver. Short stories by the late Jackie Crossland and the living Nora Randall, from 1996.
There's a river of birds in my grave.